Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
आज जो पार्टियां यहां शोर मचा रही है.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome back to Season 2 of PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an academic endeavor where we seek to understand how law is used by rising autocrats to consolidate power or by those who are trying to resist those moves. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. My guest today is Sweta Balakrishnan. Sweta has training in law and sociology and is currently assistant professor of law at UCI, the University of California, Irvine. Sweta studies the links between law, globalization, and stratification from a critical feminist perspective. Their research covers a range of sites and different levels of analysis and interrogates how law and legal institutions create, sustain, and counter different kinds of socioeconomic inequalities. Sweta is the author of Accidental Feminism, published by Princeton University Press in 2021, which unpacks the case of unintentional gender parity among India's elite legal professionals. They have also published several articles in some of the main outlets in our field, like the Law and Society Review, Law and Social Inquiry, Fordham Law Review, the International Journal of the Legal Profession, and the Journal of Professions and Organization. Sweta is also an institution builder. They have founded or co-directed several social legal initiatives at UCI and beyond, and they sit on the board of trustees of the Law and Society Association and the ISA Research Committee on the Sociology of Law. There's a whole lot that I could talk to Sweta about that would entertain listeners. But in this interview, I focus on a book Sweta edited with Sarah Desale called Invisible Institutionalisms, recently published by Hart, which brings together cross-subjective perspectives on legal globalization. Invisible Institutionalisms is a very unorthodox and inspirational work that questions the very process by which we, in academia, give meaning to law in the global context. This includes the categories that we use, like North and South, the ways in which we use these categories to code legal developments in the quote-unquote South, and the systems of incentive that drive us to reify categories and reproduce hierarchies. As I say during the episode, I find this book, in the overall conversation that it enables, very insightful to a project like PAL, which, as listeners may know, is a pilot laboratory in the Law and Society Association's Global Collaboration Program. We are tasked with experimenting new forms of collaboration between, and here we go again, Global North and Global South scholars, and with the production of new knowledge on an issue of global significance, in our case, the backsliding or erosion of democracy and the role that law plays in this process. But what does this all mean? Where does a project like ours fit in a broader power context and political economy of knowledge? These are questions that we hardly let surface in our day-to-day academic work, but these are questions that we shouldn't lose sight of. And it doesn't take more than 1 minute talking to Sweta or reading their work to understand why. You will listen to the interview after a brief message from our sponsors.
My name is Scott Fritzen, Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, which is a proud sponsor of this podcast and the institutional home of its host, Professor Desai Silva. CIS offers numerous majors and minors related to international and area studies, a flagship Master's in International Studies, a fully online Master's in Global Affairs, and 9 research centers, including the Center for Brazil Studies. Learn more about how we promote global fluency at ou.edu/CIS.
Sweta Balakrishnan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
The PAL project, which this podcast is part of, is unfolding into what I think is going to be an exciting experiment in our field. We have just been selected by the Law and Society Association to serve as a pilot topical laboratory in their brand new Global Collaboration Program, or GCP. The purpose and ambition of this program, as the name suggests, is to foster global collaboration in social legal training and research with an emphasis on Global South countries. Global social legal research has gained momentum. The relevance of Global South scholars in law and society debates has grown. So there is no question about the need for this sort of institutional recognition and response that GCP represents. But there are many questions about what it means to do global social legal work, about what accounts we are producing or reproducing in these ventures, and what role we are performing in a broader context of power. There are times when these questions surface and the elephant is put in the room, like in Trubeck and Galanter's Scholars in Self-Strangement, the piece that was published in 1974. But for the most part, scholars try to avoid those questions, to set them aside. You chose another route. In this book that you edited with Sarah Desale, you decided to confront those questions. Why did you decide to do it?
It's really interesting how you use the words decide to. I don't think it was that much of a choice. As a Global South scholar that's been doing this work in an academy that, as you say, both hyperprimes it as very important, but also undermines it when it's done on its own terms. I think these questions were not just something Sarah and I saw. I think they were central to our existence. Like we were junior scholars. We were sort of part of a community that that even with a lot of the layered privileges that we have, and we talk about them in the book, still felt inaccessible to us, right? Which both alienated us in different ways, but also included us in such alienation. And those things juxtapose themselves for Global South scholars. And Fabio, you and I have spoken about this in other contexts too, right? This idea of being the person that knows something very specific both means that you are key to that knowledge, but also that you're key to only that knowledge, right? So sitting with this idea of like, am I really a law and society India person that studies only the feminine legal profession, right? Felt like a limiting way, even as it was trying to do something that was positive. So this idea that theory can come from the South, I don't think we're the first ones to suggest it. But to be people that were coming from the South, I think it wasn't a decision to confront it. We, by just existing, had already been embedded in that confrontation. And so I think it wasn't a, I think the book itself was perhaps a decision at some point. And we can talk a little bit more about how Global North logics of what it means to be in the academy produced a book, because it didn't need to be a book. It could have just been a conversation, right? This idea of needing to produce something is also a capitalist Global North knowledge to show, to prove that you have knowledge is also a global sort of is a global understanding that is not keen to other kinds of people. So the project was supposed to be a space for that kind of conversation and thought. As someone who collaborated for the project, I hope you'll remember that we were very strict in not asking for edits that were substantive, right? So at no point would you write something and we'd say, oh, we didn't want you to write in this way, write this other way, right? So there were these prompts, and the question was, what does it really do when you are engaging with contexts that don't speak your language in the most, not English versus Portuguese versus Spanish, right? But what does it mean to have an activist in conversation with an academic, in conversation with a policymaker, in conversation with somebody for whom writing a chapter in a book really doesn't make sense? And it had a lot of its frustrations. But I think in those gaps between different kinds of language is where theory is built and made. And I think we forget that sometimes because we're also embroiled in the global north.
I love this note that you make about how the valuation of books by academics is not universally shared. There are many academic cultures that are based on much more of an oral tradition of
an oral tradition, knowledge. An activist tradition, right? It doesn't need to result in a book because they recognize that, I mean, producing a book is not a cheap process. It involves labor that is not compensated in a real way, right? One of our contributors, a dear friend who passed during the writing of the book, I remember needing to have the signature for the chapter signed by somebody who one of his heirs. And the other person was a lawyer, had no connection to academia, read the contract and said, wait, what? He just writes this thing and this knowledge just gets shared by everybody and like there's no rights to it. And I think as academics in the global north, we sort of have, this is the price for admission. We've taken it for granted. You need to publish X number of articles. You need to do Y number of things. They need to look in Z sort of way, right? Like whatever that function is, we've internalized it so much that we forget to even question whether that is knowledge. And I say this as somebody that overproduces in that strain. And I don't even ask myself, right? Like what is this knowledge doing?
Speaking of things that don't get asked about, at the center of this book is the idea that the main accounts of global legal development often make the social forces and processes that constitute law invisible. And that is really, if you think about it, it's really counterintuitive, because academic works should produce more clarity about phenomena like global legal development, or at least we hope they would. And yet you're accusing them of producing more obscurity. Can you give examples of how this happens so we can begin to unpack this point before the audience?
Yeah, I'll start by saying that the accusation is at least in part self-accusatory, right? So the idea that accounts make certain things visible, right? When I'm pointing those fingers, I'm pointing it at we were pointing it at ourselves too, which is this idea that every time we give an example of a thing or an account of a thing, that becomes the stated way in which that thing is understood. And for theory, and we're not the first ones to say this, right? So legal pluralists have spoken about this in other contexts, that whatever gets accounted for deems to irrelevance what is not spoken about. And I think Sarah and I had long conversations. So the reason the book is theorized around this idea of a dinner table conversation, right? That's the main metaphor for the book. And it borrows from performance studies. And the base idea of it is that a lot of meaning-making happens in spaces that are not spoken, right? Or in things that are not seen. So, you know, you sit at the same place over and over again with certain times, right? And it's possible that you start to make new meanings about what words mean. You start to make new communities that have knowledge and production. Now, those things might not be written. They might not be tangible accounts that you can actually make sense of. But there's an affective understanding between people who spend time over and over again that becomes knowledge of a certain sort. So that to us was very interesting as a version of knowledge, as a version of the invisible. And we had to sort of trust that there were invisible ideas that each person that we were bringing together for this project in their own praxis had that felt really visible to their communities, but felt increasingly invisible or incoherent or somewhat ambiguous to communities that they were not part of. And I think Global South scholars feel this a lot. So it was a methodological intervention, right? This idea that you might be doing something that makes complete sense to you, but the minute you take it before an audience that expects a certain normativity, the complete sense that you have can be lost and it's made invisible. And in doing that, there's a violence, right? In not seeing, there's a specific form of violence that happens to both the substance of your intervention, the possibilities of your intervention, and others who might have similar interventions that they feel like they can't voice because, you know, this has been given up on.
Yeah, and I think every Global South scholar has been through the situation where they had to conform their narrative to the terms, the very terms that the audience that they were writing to in the Global North was more used to.
Sorry,
right?
But even terms like Global South and Global North, like you and I are using it, but we're using it as short form for what we are suggesting. But to anybody outside of this tiny audience of like globalization, law and society scholars that are thinking about the Global South, those words are not doing their entire work, right? So we spent a lot of time thinking about, are these the words we want to use? What does it even mean to call something North and South? And giving them geographical coordinates, are we valorizing these terms specifically or differently, right? Like every time you say something, there is a version of it that gets stamped, and language is very useful, but language also can alienate those that are not included in it.
One solution to the problems that you're raising, like the arbitrary divide between a North and a South, is sought through what is called critical or alternative scholarship, which has led to some conceptual innovations, like the distinction between global legal developments from above or from below. You don't seem to be convinced by these solutions either. Why is that the case?
I don't know if I'm not convinced, because these are lines of scholarship that have greatly aided me in my writing and my research, right? So I think it would be very ungracious and sort of presumptuous to assume that all of these great thinkers and writers that have come before us got it wrong. I don't think that's the argument at all. But I do think new knowledge gets created when we revisit concepts, right? So there's a version of concepts that have new meaning and new sight if we can come back to it with critical generosity that time affords us. And I think a lot of these original, what I think of as original context about the North and the South, were not written by people from the South, right? They were often written by committed scholars interested in what we now call the South. And with a very few exceptions, the kinds of writing that came from the South as conceived, and the South is not just the geographical South, it's not just the political South, it's not just the economical South. There are, you know, intersections for how that South is conceived. But there's, I think our generation of scholars is sort of the first wave of scholars rooted in a specific sort of Global North Academy, while still committed to questions of the Global South within them, right? And I'm not saying we're like peculiarly new or anything, but as a mass, there are more people now studying these contexts, having come from them in a certain sense, and being self-reflexive and critical about what that ownership and positionality means, and really struggling with this idea of failing across all contexts. Part of being an interdisciplinary scholar is that you're failing on all counts, right? And I say this with kindness and generosity to myself and to others like me on this journey, right? You're constantly feeling like what I call in another book, agoraphobic. You're scared of all new spaces, because every time you say something, there's something you're missing out because you're not talking to this perfect audience, right? And so this constant feeling that you're not fully someplace is something to contend with. So theoretically, procedurally, substantively, it's something to contend with. And I think what you're reading, perhaps what I'm defending, I guess, I don't think the intention was to dismiss an entire category of scholarship. It was to add to it with self-reflexivity in a way that I think has not fully been done before, especially in this academy, right? Like we're taught that self-reflexive scholarship is almost indulgent, right? We're taught not to use those tools because they're not analytical enough. And so to make way for queer phenomenologies or to make way for feminist phenomenologies that have always actually thought about narrative as informing theory or thought about dispositions outside of the Global North idea of what scholarship is, was central to the project. It was really part of what we were committed to building and growing.
So why don't you give some examples to the audience of how this exercise of trying to make the invisible visible happens throughout the book or in your work, and why those divisions between Global North and South, or from above and from below, kind of fall short in terms of their ability to account for what's at stake?
So any calibration between the North and the South or above from below starts from a positionality that one is, you might not call it superior, but you are assuming that there is a power dynamic within the North and the South, or the, you know, however you call it. So one of the things we do in the Invisible Institutionalism's book is to match people who would not be in conversation with each other, either because they are in different disciplines, at different stages of their career, in different sort of capacities, right? So an environmental law scholar who's a theorist in touch with a Colombian writer who's also a lawyer who happens to study white collar crime, right? Those are not people who would normally be in conversation with each other. And it, in a sense, it queers that interaction because it forces people who have no concept of the North and the South, or have a concept of the North and the South, but it's not defined in exactly the same way, to contend with each other on terms that are not pre-negotiated. And part of what that does is that it makes visible coordinates that have not yet been mapped before. And I know I'm trying to be really abstract here, but hopefully there's some resonance for those listening, that the way in which the act produces knowledge is by paying attention to what would normally have not happened, because normative knowledge production has an audience, has a position, and has a performance that is very linear. In forcing people to be in conversation with each other that had nothing to do with each other, except they were actually talking at each other. And we don't make them make up scholarship, right? So we don't make them perform a certain version of binding, right? So we don't say, oh, can you find out a way in which your scholarship can speak to this scholarship? That was not the project, because that project, again, is a, you know, what does the North teach the South, or the South teach the North? It's still a power. There's still a conduit from which knowledge flows. Here it's literally what happens when two people who are not supposed to be talking to each other share. What becomes visible? What becomes heard? And how do we see differently when that happens? And I think that was one example methodologically, and it repeats itself across the chapters in the book, in which the invisible becomes visible. The other way in which we try and do it, and it links to the self-reflexivity point I was just talking about, was we asked at the, so if you notice the book is built into two major parts. The first is sort of, there's a chapter, there's a response, there's a chapter and a response. And this was trying to get people who, like we said, who wouldn't normally speak to each other in conversation. And then we end it with, you know, who we think of as like these meta scholars in law and society. And the only thing we asked of them was to be self-reflexive about their journeys, right? And again, to talk about the invisible and the visible, this is people in positions of power getting vulnerable about what their journey was. And I think the importance of that, especially for junior law and society scholars, was to be able to witness the fact that not everybody got there starting as a star, right? So these fields that we think of as existent now didn't exist 30 years ago. They were built ground up by people who were interested in asking questions that were invisible at the time to become visible over time. And hopefully that offered new spaces of visibility and sort of reflexivity for others reading and watching to say, oh, maybe I'm asking stuff that in 30 years could then become visible enough to offer new spaces. And I mean, that's definitely the hope. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but that was the hope.
This is all fascinating. But what I like the most about your argument is that even when you criticize the main lines of scholarship on global legal development for producing this much of invisibility, you don't put the blame on scholars for those failures or shortcomings. Rather, you see those failures or shortcomings as products of the social structures and hierarchies that scholars inhabit, and which legitimize some accounts and delegitimize others. Why don't you talk about these forces as they appear not only in your book, but also in your experience, where, as we discussed in the beginning, they surely do?
I really appreciate this question, because I think it's such a generous reading of the book, and it offers it a visibility, to overuse that term, I guess, in metaphor, that really marks it specifically. So I want to just say I appreciate the reading, because we were trying to do that. We were trying to make sure that this was not dismissing individual scholars, but a sort of necessary orientation that I think all of us were part of. Before I actually tell you what I think those orientations are, let me also mention that part of what's central to this analysis is the recognition that you can't, that without these scholars actually having set up the stage as they did, Sarah and I could not have done what we did to add to it, right? So, you know, these movements don't happen overnight. We think of scholarship as like sort of much more atemporal than that, right? Things move forward, they move back, and then some people set the stage, and then you get to add to it and subtract from it and redact from it as you go on. And I mention this because I think that distinction changes how we think about agency in what you produce, right? So you think about structure. I mean, I'm trained as a sociologist, and I think structure and agency is sort of central to all the ways in which I think about who gets to say what and do what. And one of the major power structures that sort of constrain a lot of what we say is the academy, right? So it's the academy and who was first there to produce it and who reproduces it and who thinks of these hierarchies as necessary or not necessary. It's, you know, what you have to publish to get tenure, what you then have to publish to become a renowned scholar in a specific field, right? So I'm in a law school. What does it mean for me to produce sociolegal scholarship? Like, it might not be the same in every school. That changes what I can say. That structure changes where I publish, right? And if I actually wanted to make the caveats possible for every single thing I had to write, I would never send anything out to press, right? So writing as a activity is necessarily produced by a specific hierarchy. The academy is full of such hierarchies. I'm mentioning one such thing because I'm, you know, a juniorish scholar going up for tenure, right? But you can imagine that it looks very different for somebody at a different stage of their scholarship. You can imagine it's different for someone in an interdisciplinary department between sort of sites. You can imagine it's completely different for someone who's not even in an American academy or a global not set up and actually whose publication record doesn't mean X, right? So what our actions mean is produced so much by our structures that to be people 30 years down the line and reading this and saying, oh, but you didn't do this and you set up a violent structure and making it about the person seems sort of not just unjust, but also it doesn't make analytical sense. We're all products of the structures we're stuck between, right? I hope, because this would mean progress, that in 30 years or 40 years, someone reads this book and it's like, you know, this was just doing some reproduction of hierarchy. Maybe it won't even take 30 years, right? But you can imagine a version of it where they read this and think this is stale content, or they think this is a shortcoming of a specific sort because it reproduces many hierarchies, many of which I'd like to think Sarah and I mentioned in the book in both our introduction and the ways in which we weave together in the chapters. But those products happen constantly. Those structures are omnipresent. I mean, I think the academy is one such structure, but there are other structures that I think are constantly present, both in, I think the very structures that give us advantages are also the ones that hold us captive to do the stuff that we have to do.
You must have talked 4 or 5 times by now about the importance of self-reflexivity, which I see as the main takeaway from your book, and which is of special importance for a project like ours that deals with democracy and the rule of law, which are topics that, by their very nature, are often understood through the lens of the West, which constrains a lot the terms in which those thinking about politics in countries from, quote and unquote, the global South, come to make sense of what they're looking at, leading many of them to, as you say in your book, catalog some practices as anomalies, or to elevate U.S. institutions to a benchmark status when there's so much that could be questioned about the integrity of those institutions. And these are traps that we can only avoid if we are very self-reflective about what we are doing and what we are articulating.
I think self-reflexivity is crucial across projects, but I think it's especially crucial at a time like this, right? I'm guessing maybe all scholars think the time in which they're operating is the most specific time, but we can't help but think that this is an incredibly opportune time for both global connectedness and, as you mentioned, global understandings of words and knowledge, right? Like, so this idea that democracy, for example, is expected to be operationalized in a specific way comes from a global north understanding of what that ought to look like. So I'm a gender scholar. I think a lot about, you know, law's connection of with modernity and sort of, it's always fascinating to me how, you know, liberal ideas of what modernity is are supposed to then be what progress looks like for women across the world, right? So my current project is on, among other things, sort of the ways in which Muslim lawyers navigate spaces, right? So this idea of an ideal professional is always, you need to look, you don't, you know, we don't mind what it is, we're agnostic to what your religious preferences are, but when you're in the space, be professional, right? And that always means an expectation that progress will include a certain way of presentation that is seen as neutral and secular, without actually acknowledging that neutral and secular is also modern within a very Anglo-Saxon context that is not specific to anyone else, right? So what is neutral to, you know, a Hindu woman who wants to wear a nose pin or not that, you know, I'm giving one random example from the interviews, but, or a Muslim woman who, you know, covers in a specific way is not supposed to be, might be neutral within their own home context, right? If you take away where you start that neutrality from, assuming that there are objective standards without actually interrogating the nature of those standards and seeing anything that is different or distinct from those standards as needing to be accommodated is what is truly problematic with our legal systems. And sort of it's the incapacity to see these objective standards as in themselves subjective is a pattern that keeps coming up for any of us on the periphery in whatever way you construct it. This idea of needing to include subsumes within itself the assumption that what is doing the inclusion is good and normative and ideal, without really being critical or thoughtful about what it is we're starting from. So what if we flip the script and start from somewhere else?
This leads to a point that probably is going to be one of the main contributions from this interview to the scholars involved in our project or projects alike, which is methodology. It is very difficult to break free from those structural forces and hierarchies and the incentives that they create for us to craft our accounts in a certain expected way. But the very place to do this is when we are designing research, when we are choosing our research sites, when we are choosing the subjects and the sources that we will consult, when we are drafting our research questions and designing our instruments. Your book stems from a rather transgressive methodology that I don't think we can reproduce in the PAL project. But what tips would you give us as we structure a comparative international project about the entanglements between law and democratic backsliding with a focus on the global south, namely Brazil, India, and South Africa?
So I'm a big fan of comparative sites. I think holding different things constant as you do an analysis and being theoretically rigorous about how you do methods is a really important way in which to think about our sites. And especially for scholars who study what is seen as on the periphery, right? It's a word we use in the book, but it's also a word more generally in the research on when you start from what is deemed to be the periphery, it's both important to locate the periphery as an important point of analysis, methodologically speaking, whatever methods you use in the research design phase, but also to make sure that your scholarship has appeal beyond the specific context of whatever that periphery is, right? So my first book was on Indian women lawyers, and it was both important that it located them as starting points. So it didn't, this is a specific example, so that the comparison wasn't American women in large law firms, which is what everybody in the early stages of my research asked me about, right? They were like, what does this mean for American law firms? And you're like, well, this is not about American law firms. Like, it's not like every book on American law firms says, what is it like for Indian law firms? They don't ask that. They always ask this when you write about India. They're like, well, what does this really say about other parts of the world, right? And that's a question that only people who study the periphery have to answer, right? And so I think it's important for scholars to be able to spend enough time on their point of view to be able to establish it as enough on its own right. But the flip is also true, that the minute you become that scholar, then you also have to be very clear about what the extensions from that periphery are for others looking to do this kind of work, right? So for me, it was really important. And it took 10 years to figure this out. And I think another lesson here is that when you're doing methodology, the way in which you construct the project versus what you write from it and how you speak about it will change. It's a non-linear, exacting process that's going to take time before you know exactly how it is you want to talk about this over time. But for me, what that meant was at the end of that period, I could look back and think, okay, this is about, you know, gender and India and professionalization in a specific context. And it affords way to think about, you know, global understandings of isomorphism, right? That happened to be the theory in one of the things that I was writing about. But it was important to be able to connect it back to a larger theory that was not just about it. So when people said, what's your book about? And I'm like, oh, it's about how global diffusion of concepts get understood in different sites. Because that's true. That's also what the book is about. Because the last thing I think it's important, you know, strategically, but also methodologically, to not be the scholar that studies just that tiny intersection of things that you study as a site. And that's a hard balance, but I think methodologically that is sort of what is at stake, both to be able to understand the positionality of your site very specifically and not be nudged into always making it about the global north. But on the other hand, really be clear about how deep you can go to build grounded theory. I mean, as an ethnographer, that's sort of what I'm always concerned with. It's like, what is the grounded theory from this site? And really ask the hard questions of how it relates to other sites and other contexts and other possibilities beyond the very specificities of what you study.
I agree. And I think this can even result in us being able to question some of the taken for granted assumptions about Global North institutions, which is a point I make, as you know, in my chapter to your book, how when I teach students about corruption in Brazil, initially, they are like, oh, yeah, of course, Brazil is corrupt. But when I unpack the latest corruption scandal with them, and I show that most of what this scandal involves would be perfectly legal in the United States, where the law of the land is dictated by cases like Citizens United and McDonald, then they are like, oh, okay, so corruption is not about Brazil, it's about money in politics. And money in politics is something we have plenty of here. And this is the kind of critical reflection that you can't foster if you only make your paper or your class about corruption in Brazil. So I'm totally with you that we need to try to extrapolate from these sites that we study, or to put our findings from these sites in conversation with theory that has been built to explain what happens in other sites, without which we risk producing almost a reversed exceptionalism, as if what happens with women or with politics in India and Brazil couldn't happen anywhere else in the quote and unquote global north. But since you mentioned your studies on gender in India and how to possibly extrapolate from these studies to explain broader phenomena, let me throw something else on your plate. One of the next steps in our project involves looking at the nexus between gender and democratic backsliding in sites including India. What do you think that nexus might be?
There's something about, I think the nexus between democracy, gender, and India is much more about populism and the ways in which new meanings of what it means to be, for example, India has a very right-wing Hindu nationalist government in place right now. And you could argue that that is not a win for democracy. And that is not, you know, but actually it is more public participation than we've ever seen before. It actually is a populist outcome. It just isn't an elite left liberal outcome in a way that matters, right? So when Trump won as a foreigner in this country, it was not that striking. I mean, and people said, oh, this is a loss for democracy. As someone that's from the outside, I have to say, I mean, it sort of didn't seem, it seemed like it was much more representative of a large section of this population that was not seen as, that was unsavory, was not seen as wanting to be represented, when in fact, there is very much that representation in every one of these spaces, right? So our current prime minister is voted by a section of the, is not voted by a peripheral section of our country. It is a populist democracy that actually has voted into power who is best reflective of the population. And those of us that study it might look at it and think, oh, this is not good democracy. But actually, if you think about the nexus between populism and democracy, which I think scholars are increasingly paying attention to, that then shifts how we actually consider the lack of democracy, or like what it means for the failure of democracy to happen, right? Because then you also have to take into account what the success of populism looks like.
But once these leaders get to power, they take actions that compromise women's rights and the prospect for women's empowerment. How do we take that into account in our analysis?
I don't think there's one women's empowerment. I don't think there is one particular way in which this plays out. I think there is, I think empowerment can look as simple as having the choice to make a choice, right? And that what that choice looks like could be very different. It doesn't have to look like, so for example, there is lower female workplace participation now in India, right? Like, and this dropping, right? This dropping rates of female workplace participation has been something demographers have been paying attention to, which at the large scale data is really worth looking at, right? So, but more minute data on very elite professional work shows that there's been an increase in this work. And there's been an increase in the kinds of ways in which very highly educated women can expand in professional hierarchies. Right, those two things are at odds with each other. So depending on where you're looking, what looks like progress might look very different. Political participation, likewise, looks very different depending on what state you're paying attention to. It depends on what the history of political agenda in female empowerment in each of those states has looked like, right? So someone just saying, oh, in India, gender is a problem, right, is not actually saying very much. That's like saying in general, North America, gender is a problem. Like, sure, it's true, right? Like, but what does it mean from state to state? What does it mean from time period to time period? What is the age you're talking about? How does a caste intersectionality play out in terms of who's having different outcomes? What is what role does networks make? What role does, you know, capital play? I'm you know, again, throwing out broad categories, but the specificities of understanding these regions require true interplay with, I think, actors on the field that are actually doing this work in very specific ways, which is something that your project does so well. And it requires an attention to the nuance, which gets missed out if you just think about it as, you know, empowerment and democracy and movement, or even India as a concept.
Speaking of gender and power, but in the scholarly context we began this interview with, here's another question I have for you. Having to put this podcast together made me realize how some important intellectual debates are still heavily dominated by white males, and how much work needs to be done to promote the scholarship and the ideas of women, non-binary people, and non-whites. How would you say that your gender and racial positionalities affect your career? And what needs to change so that we have more equality in law and society?
It's funny, I actually think law and society is not the space where there isn't that. I think the hardest conversations about identity, and you're on the board now, so you know that these hard conversations about what does it mean to do good diversity? How do we actually think about identity in this context, or how do we get people to self-represent in the way that is most accessible? These are hard questions that I think the association asks more than any other, well, more than other spaces that I am part of. So I think within law and society is not where the where I have experienced the equity or in any way the equality issue. I think it's actually in other spaces that aren't quite as accommodating as LSA, that happens. And the ways in which it happens is not straightforward. I think at different parts of the journey, they've been differently inclusive and exclusionary. Like I said, those things sit side by side, right? These things don't happen all together, just in the same ways that your international identity is both very attractive to people who want to know something very specific about the context you study, but also use it as an excuse to not include you into larger conversations about what is seen as neutral. I think the same is true for those that have, you know, queer identities that are not fully assimilated into theory in some ways, right? So it's still a version of accommodation rather than thinking about it as equal footing from which to build analysis or thought from.
I wanted to end this with a request for you to share with our audience three resources that they can build upon to become better global social legal scholars. It can be readings, it can be non-academic sources, it can be pieces of advice, it can be words of encouragement, whatever you think they should be giving attention to.
I think from a sort of big project perspective, one of the projects that has really done global law and society theory beautifully, that is contemporary, but also really engages with people from the sites while also speaking to larger conversations, is the GLEE project that from Harvard Law School that works on, you know, India, Brazil, and China. And as you know, it's David Wilkins is who like sort of brought me into it when I was a pre-doctoral fellow many, many years ago. But it is, I think, the project that does the work of building community across contexts and across hierarchy in a very specific way, right? So, I definitely, the Trubeck Wilkins project is sort of the first of many, and I'm happy to talk more about that if that's helpful. The second is, I mean, and this sounds sort of self-serving, but I would love it if people engaged with the introduction that Sarah and I, to the book that Sarah and I have, not because you should cite it or engage with it or do anything substantive with it, but I hope it offers some kind of way in which to think a little bit differently about collaboration. And it's free and it's available on the website. But I'm also happy to send anybody a copy of anything they want to read if they send me a note. But I think that's the sort of second note I have. And the third is actually, if you let me do it, a piece of advice. I think people should try and connect with at least one thing when you're at Law and Society that you don't think you're going to be interested in. This sounds like counterintuitive, but I think it's a really inclusive community and a lot of people end up just following exactly what it is they study. But I think oftentimes, at least for me personally, the best sparks of innovation in both theory and research and writing have come from spaces I least expected it, right? And so to go to a talk or listen to a, you know, or listen in on a lecture or pay attention to a group or just go to a business meeting of somebody of a CRN that you didn't even think you were going to want to do, right? Something about dipping into contexts that have nothing to do with what you study can offer spaces of deep introspection that I think serves research in ways that we're not trained to do. And I think if I could offer one queer tool to come back to our theory with more integrity, that would be it.
That was Sweta Balakrishnan. Thanks for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you so much. It was really great. Thank you for having me. I appreciated this.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, drop me a note at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.